Meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. I know people are still coming in, but we're so pressed for time, we need to get going. The time is 2:04 p.m. Members present at this time, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative George Rausser, Co-Chair Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast. Thank you. And our LIO moderator is Madison Truitt. Thank you so much for your help today. We could please ask folks to silence their cell phones as we get started. We'd appreciate that. We have two items on today's calendar, and we have to do them in a little bit of strange order because of the delayed start. We have House Bill 331 in consideration of the amendments for House Bill 331 and then possibly moving that bill from committee if it's the will of committee. And then we have the remainder of the presentation on the Ambler Road Project. Unfortunately, one of the presenters for the Ambler Road Project is only available for the next 25 minutes. So we are going to have that person go first and do that part of the presentation. Then we're going to hit the pause button on that because we need to get back to 331. But want to be respectful to this person, Dr. Zamzow, who actually drove all the way to the Matsu LIO from Chickaloon last week and was not able to present. And so this is the second try, and really appreciate when Alaskans are willing to put their time in to be a part of our process. So thank you to Dr. Zamzow. And if you could please state your name for the record, and then we would want to finish your presentation, I'd say, in the next 15 to 20 minutes, if we could keep that time frame in mind, because we want to have at least a good portion of the remaining time for House Bill 331. Dr. Zamzow.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. I can hear you, but I don't have visual yet. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kendra Zamzo. I am an environmental geochemist and a 30-year resident of Alaska. I work for the Center for Science in Public Participation, which is a nonprofit. And my role is to primarily review technical documents on mining projects and highlight the potential risks for communities and tribes. Do you have the first slide up?
We do.
Okay, great. My conclusions for this project, from what I have reviewed to date, is that it is much too soon for the state to invest in infrastructure. Exploration in the Ambler District has not yet achieved a level of confidence that mining could be conducted profitably on even a single, let alone multiple ore deposits. I base this conclusion on the following. Not a single ore deposit has been shown to have what is called measured resources or proven reserves, terms which provide a level of certainty that mining could be profitable. Second, drilling has been extremely limited. Much more extensive drilling requiring years of work will be needed to define the ore bodies and determine potential viability. Lastly, only one company is exploring the area despite several known deposits. We go to slide two. The area has rich deposits of copper and zinc, but these alone are not enough to state with confidence that mining can be conducted with a profit. The size, the shape, the continuity of the ore bodies will strongly affect the cost of mining, as will the geology. So as looking at stages of exploration, we are now in the middle stage. The early stage showed we do have rich deposits there. Now we need to find out a lot more about the ore body itself. Can we go to the next slide? When mining companies report to investors, the language they use reflects the modifying factors that place constraints on the viability of a profitable mine. Rich ore means they have a mineral resource. That's the stage where we are now. The level of confidence in how much rich ore they have in a condensed area is referenced using the terms inferred, indicated, and measured mineral resources, which reflect increasing confidence in a well-defined ore body. To date, there are no measured resources that reflect high confidence at any deposit in the Ambler District. Associated with the term mineral resources is the term mineral reserves. Resources shows the level of confidence in the ore body. Reserves is the level of confidence that the ore body can be mined profitably. Reserves considers the many economic costs, such as providing power and infrastructure, as well as the cost of water treatment and closure. The Arctic deposit is a massive sulfide-style deposit, and as such, this will increase the cost of closure because of the geochemistry of the ore body. And this is important to consider when determining the actual profitability of the mine. Reserves are either probable or proven. The Arctic deposit pre-feasibility study was just released late on Friday and is the first document to state that there are probable mineral reserves. This is the lower confidence level. Whether this label can be maintained will likely depend in part on whether the mining company or the state pays for the proposed Ambler Road. This is my first concern. I would caution that even if the state pays for the road without proven mineral reserves, the road could be in place and not a single mine would go in. And there are two quick animations there, some statements, one of which shows the disclaimer that is required on annual forms reported by the mining company that indicated mineral resources, which is what we have right now from the drilling at Arctic, may or may not ever be upgraded to the measured, which is the high confidence level. Next slide, please. My second concern is the lack of effort in exploration. Between 2004 and 2017, less than 100 boreholes were drilled at the Arctic deposit and less than 60 at Bornite, which is across the valley. Hundreds more will need to be drilled to define the edges of the ore body and conduct the infilling that's necessary to determine the consistency, the shape, and the depth. These are the first steps to increasing the level of confidence in the deposit itself, regardless of the economics. You can't reach this level of confidence by drilling 5 to 7 boreholes per year, which is roughly the effort expended by Nova Copper or Trilogy. If you could click through, there's three animations that show you how drilling. There's blue vertical lines represent drill holes into an ore deposit, and the thick black represents what you can infer from that drilling information. And as you can see, you can go from what you would hope might be a very large resource could end up to be somewhat scattered. And that really changes how mining could occur, whether mining would be profitable, and how it would be done, for instance, whether it be surface or underground. Trilogy's effort is in strong contrast to other exploration areas that have shown promise. For example, at Donlin, Placer Dome had 2.2 million ounces of measured resources, the high level of confidence, within 5 years of exploration. When Nova Gold took over exploration at Donlin, they drilled over 200 boreholes per year between 2006 and 2008 to better define the ore body. At Pebble, Northern Dynasty had 5 billion pounds of measured resources within 3 years and drilled an average of 135 boreholes per year between 2002 and 2008. This is the kind of level of effort that we need to see to have confidence that an ore body can become a mine. It not only defines the ore body, but this kind of level of effort in drilling is done to conduct the geotechnical work to develop the mine design. We've already seen some tentative mine design with the tailings facility. A lot more geotechnical work may need to be done to determine what those soil resources are under that facility. So my second concern is that exploration work is proceeding at such an agonizingly slow rate that it could be decades before there is a well-defined ore body and enough information to support a mine design. Next slide, please. ADEA has stated a conceptual plan for 4 mines opening simultaneously in the Ambler District. I've noted the extremely limited drilling being conducted by Trilogy at the Arctic and Bornite deposits, and they are the only company exploring at all. This slide highlights the 4 deposits that ADEA has talked about, Arctic and Bornite, that Trilogy are conducting drilling on. Sun and Smucker have no drilling occurring and no interest in drilling that I've been able to determine. Companies that have, Sun has changed companies several times, One of the last ones recently went bankrupt. Smucker is owned by Tech, but they have shown so little interest in it that it's not in their annual reports and it's not on their website. So in conclusion, if we could go to the last slide, I would like to emphasize that rich ore does not necessarily make a mine. There has been far too little effort extended at the Ambler District by Trilogy or any other mining company to have confidence that even a single mine, let alone several, will open. The state should be very cautious at this stage. They should wait until there are at minimum measured resources at several mines and at best proven reserves. That would be at the point at which to consider infrastructure. It is simply much too early to invest. And thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much. Just to get everybody sort of on the same page here. So at 2:06 p.m., we were joined by Representative Birch and Representative Lincoln. Dr. Zamzow, who's presenting on the Ambler Road, is the other half of the presentation we didn't finish last week. And we're hoping to spend maybe about 10 more minutes on this presentation, and then we're going to go to House Bill 331. And hopefully we'll have time to come back for the remainder of that. So that's what's happening. I think it was Representative Rauscher had a question first, then Representative Birch. Did you have a question?
Actually, I'll just take the opportunity, Madam Co-Chair. Dr. Zamzow, it's Andy Josephs, and I just wanted to thank you for your testimony and for the extra effort in getting to the LIO.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Zamzow, I was wondering, you've gone through a lot of work here. You provided a lot of diagrams. I'm just wondering, in your opinion, do you feel that this mine will go forward?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, at this stage, it certainly won't go forward in the near future. Whether it goes forward several decades from now, that's certainly a possibility.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I got here a couple minutes late, and I didn't miss the introduction and qualifications of the person who was speaking through the chair. If you could maybe restate that for the couple of us that were your engagement in this project and issue would be I'm just wondering what's motivated you to be here today and who's paying for it through the chair.
Yes, Representative Birch through the chair. My name is Kendra Zamzow. My qualifications are I have a degree in environmental chemistry with a focus in biogeochemistry, which is primarily trace metals and mining, how that moves through the environment. I've spent the last 10 years looking at technical documents, which is the geology of an ore body, the hydrology of an ore body, and looking at the potential risks, which vary depending on each mine. Most of my testimony is based on some work I did for some people in the Brooks Range called the Brooks Range Council. My testimony today, my time was paid for by the Wilderness Society. I work for the Center for Science in Public Participation, which is a nonprofit, and we have a mix. We're paid for by a mix of grant money and payment by clients.
Thank you. A follow-up?
Sure.
Yeah, you understand that this what we're actually talking about is a road project, right? It's the mineral aspects are all well and good, but do you have any sort of testimony or observations regarding the road? The analogies have been made regarding the DeLong Mountain Transportation System. I think we had testimony on Friday that basically said that was a good project, good investment, and so forth. But do you have any particular observations or sense regarding the specifics on the road through the chair?
Yes, Representative Birch through the chair. The reason that I'm bringing up the mining is my concern is that the road may not be paid for if there are no mines. And at this point, mining is speculative enough that I feel like we should wait to pay for a road to this area.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Lincoln has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you brought up some excellent points, as did the presenter, I think, on Saturday. But it seems obvious to me that the state wouldn't would invest a huge amount of money or allow for bonds to be authorized without doing due diligence. So I'm trying to understand what I perceive to be a sense of urgency with you and another presenter around this. I mean, the roads and EIS, the level of investment and exploration kind of goes hand in hand with the possibility of having a road. So could you just help me understand why the urgency and why the need to encourage us to do something that strikes me as being pretty obvious when we get to that point?
Yes, Representative Lincoln, through the chair. From what I've been able to see, the state is moving forward through AIDEA with the EIS and potentially to fund a Pioneer Road. And my concern is that the Pioneer Road could cost $300 million of state money that we need for a lot of other projects. And if the state moves forward without more definite confidence in several ore bodies, this will be a waste of money. If we're just simply talking about a road to a port, it's an entirely different situation. But if we're talking about a road that will be repaid by mines, then I think it's really relevant whether we actually will have mines in that area. And at this point, we simply don't have that information.
The follow-up?
No, I'm in total agreement, and we're not contemplating a major investment at this point. So if we get to that point, then I hope you're involved in that conversation at the appropriate time.
Any other questions for Dr. Zamzow? Representative Parrish. And just if we try to stay on track, try and wrap this portion up in about 3 minutes, if possible.
Sure, and thank you, Dr. Zamzow, for your presentation. I haven't been following mines going into production as closely as you have. Would you say that, or what proportion of mines have this fairly low level of activity before they go forward? You said Donlin had about 20 times more holes drilled in a year. I think it was a little bit more than that, although I've forgotten the figure. Can you speak to that? Is there a good likelihood that if we were to build the road, the mine would open? And if not, what would you assess that likelihood at?
Yeah, Representative Parrish, through the chair, I simply don't have enough information to say if a mine will ever open or not. I would like to do a little more background information on this, but I did look at a couple of other mines. I looked at Red Dog, Galore Creek, and Rock Creek. Red Dog, the information is very limited because it was before, it was in the 1980s. Their material simply wasn't being posted online, and it might have been before some of the SEC requirements that are in place right now. I do know that they went from the very first drill hole to a mine and operations in 13 years or less. And at this point, Nova Copper and Trilogy have been drilling in the Arctic area for over 16 years. Galore Creek, that's a Nova Gold operation. They took over 700 drill holes before they got into indicated and measured resources. Rock Creek was over 400 drill holes, and I don't believe they ever reached measured resources. I would have to double check that. They had around 10 to 20, maybe 30 million tons of indicated, which is roughly what we have at this point right now at Ambler. For those of you that aren't familiar with Rock Creek, that mine did go into production for 2 months, and then it was closed down for a variety of reasons. So it seems to me that we need several hundred drill holes, which, again, is going to take, if they do 14 holes a year, it's going to take another decade before we have a really well-defined ore body. And that's my concern, is the state investing money in an EIS at this stage when it could be another 10 years before we even know if a mine will go in, let alone whether there will be two or three or four.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Dr. Zamzow, the second mine you mentioned, I'm familiar with Rock Creek, but what was the second mine? Did you say Galore or Delore?
There's one called Galore Creek. It's actually in Canada, B.C.
Okay. Thank you.
And so, Dr. Zamzow, would it be your position that even going through the EIS process is premature at this time and that we should be, you know, waiting till such time as the companies have done enough of their own exploration work that we've gotten to measured resources?
Through the chair, I think that would be wise.
Okay. Representative Lincoln has a question. Pardon me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know the total cost estimated for the EIS?
Representative Lincoln, through the chair, I do not know the total cost estimate.
Does anyone in the room know the total cost?
Mr. Terrio, if you want to join us. Please put yourself on the record, if you would, please.
Yes, Madam Chairman, Gene Terrio for ADA. And to the representative's question, I'm sorry, off the top of my head, I don't know exactly what has been expended to date, but a sizable amount of money that was previously appropriated by the legislature has been expended on taking the project over from DNR, the scoping meetings that are taking place. Of course, all of that work, even the consultants that produce documents on behalf of BLM, the state, as the applicant, has paid for using state money. I know that there has been a request to consultants to provide information to ADA on what they believe the amount of money that would be needed to get to a record of decision. And it's in my view, I think it's maybe $1 million or $1 million, something like that, but still would be a small amount compared to what's been expended already. And so I think for policymakers, the consideration is, you know, how much money has been invested now? Will that value be captured if you stop the process now? Or does it make sense to at least get to a record of decision? Getting to a record of decision does not guarantee that a road project goes forward. And in fact, I did supply to the staff a document out of the statutes that clarified, you know, what I believe was a critical misstatement on Friday, that ADA cannot issue bonds that obligate the state of Alaska. There was testimony on Friday, and I transcribed it, that ADA plans to finance the project with municipal bonds with an interest rate of 2.75%. Assume that the rate is so low for such a high-risk project that they are general obligation bonds in the state, that is, you and I, are guaranteeing any revenue shortfall from the tolls. The fact of the matter is, ADA statutes at 4488.120 prohibit ADA for obligating the state of Alaska. It says specifically the bonds issued by the authority do not constitute an indebtedness or other liability of the state or of a political subdivision of the state. So basically the mechanism is that we're in the process of is the state provided money for this initial risk of seeing whether a road project transportation corridor could even be permitted. If the answer comes back that says, yes, it can be, it doesn't mean that ADA will move forward. Certainly won't spend state monies unless the legislature were to appropriate state monies. Won't even go out to the bond market unless we can show that there's a business plan that will, in fact, allow the users of the road to pay back the bonded indebtedness. And so, you know, that ADA was specifically set up as a mechanism to help facilitate projects to get access to the bond market without obligating the citizens of the state.
Representative Lincoln has a follow-up.
So you're unsure about how much state money has been spent so far, but the best estimate you have at this point is to finish the EIS, it would be an additional $1 million?
Madam Chairman, I know that I believe in the original appropriation there is about $2 or $3 million left. Okay. As a request just went out to consultants to ask for what they thought the budget might be to get to a record of decision, the only information I got back just conversationally was that there was a thought that it would only be a portion of the remaining money. So I can get you more detailed information about the total spend to date and what the anticipated spend would be to get the record of decision.
And can you remind me again of how much ADA, annual revenue from just DMTS ADA gets?
Madam Chairman, now I'm right at across the line of not having that at my fingertips. So there's likely to be somebody else from ADA.
The last time I looked at it was, Madam Chair, is $20 million a year that ADA earns from the use of the DeLong Mountain Transportation System. That's something like 40% of your profits and 80% of your bonding capacity. So we're talking about, you know, a couple of million dollars to finish, to see through an EIS project that's extremely important to a lot of Alaskans, but, you know, especially in my district, people who've shown up for meetings, expressed their concerns, asked questions in a very sincere with a lot of concerns. So I just, I've appreciated a lot of the comments from the presenter so far, but I absolutely reject the idea that, you know, another couple million dollars investment is not worthwhile in this, you know, for the state, especially in the light of the fact that ADA is bringing in, you know, $20 million plus a year off one road in Northwest Alaska.
Madam Chairman, that is true. It's been a very good project for the state of Alaska. And since ADA started paying back a dividend, the original capitalization of the entity has been all paid back to the state of Alaska, plus, you know, almost $400 million. So the enterprise that allows us, again, to help projects without using general fund dollars to access the bond market and then charge a fee for that, we're actually helping people to access other people's money. And it's been a tremendous economic engine for the state of Alaska.
I know we need to move on to the other part of the hearing. We're going to come back to this. Do you recall, Mr. Terrio, I think it was a $10 million appropriation that went in the capital budget maybe in 2012 or 13, somewhere around then, for the Ambler Access Road to Resources. I believe it was part of Governor Parnell's. And I guess I'm just trying to get a number of what the state may have spent so far, just for our like comparison purposes. Do you have that by chance?
Madam Speaker, I'm Chairman. I'm sorry, I should have refreshed my memory on that. Could we just see if there is somebody from ADA that is on the line listening and that could answer those questions?
There is not at this time.
I will get that information and deliver it to your office individually.
Okay, that sounds really good. So let's just hit the pause button on this portion so we can get to House Bill 331, because we're going to get kicked out of the room at, you know, 5:10 after. And there's so much interest in this legislation, we need to get to it. So thank you, Dr. Zamzow. Really appreciate your time and information today. And this will be a conversation that continues. So that brings House Bill 331 before us. It looks like there's been a handout. It's not identified, but I believe this handout came from the Department of Revenue. Is that correct? Okay, so we will just make sure to make that clear online, and we'll put this on basis that this is a Department of Revenue generated handout. We had a hearing on Saturday where we spent a couple of hours with folks, hopefully getting all of the questions answered, talking through in a very detailed and comprehensive way all of the different considerations for this legislation. We have two amendments for consideration. Is there any committee discussion before we go to the amendments? Representative Birch.
I just want to say I like this idea. I've had have had an opportunity to have some discussion with constituents and folks that do like the idea of the state of Alaska honoring our commitments made in the past, and the positive impact that these dollars will have on the economy or be would be well received. I think it's a well structured effort, and I certainly urge us to act on this expeditiously. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Any other questions? And I guess I was thinking, just are there any questions about the actual legislation before we go into the amendments? Mr. Mitchell, I see, is here and could perhaps join us.
Is Mr. Alper going to be there?
I know we saw Mr. Alper. I don't know if he's planning on coming back or if he's in the hallway. Perhaps if he could be flagged down, that would be helpful as well.
That's what we're hoping for.
Okay, excellent.
Because I'm not the leader for the Department of Revenue.
Okay. Okay. So it looked like Genevieve was going to try and flag him down. So hopefully everyone has the two amendments. And as hopefully he's being called back to the committee, folks can look at the amendments. We'll take a brief at ease. Before we go into the amendments, I believe the department prepared this handout, and I don't know if you want to make any comments about the handout, just for the record, prior to the amendments.
Sure. So, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. So, at our hearing on Saturday afternoon, we talked about providing an example to the committee of an estimate that we provided to each of the 37 tax credit holders. And so what you have before you is hopefully two documents, and it's an example of what we provided, but it's de-identified, and so the numbers that you see there aren't representative of any of the 37 tax credit holders. It was simply a hypothetical example to show you what it looked like and how it works. And so the two examples are under the – can I just – okay. So under the version that goes through FY24 in the leftmost column, that's prepared as if this bill were to pass into law. And under the example that shows it going through FY2031, mm-hmm. that is an example that would –
Deputy Commissioner, pardon me for the interruption, but I believe that we only have one of those sheets. We have the one that goes through 2031.
Well, there's two, so maybe we could.
Madam Chair, there's two purposes to this exercise. The first, as I spoke to on Saturday at the hearing, was to just sort of show what we did and to show, because our four-year by $25 million example in the presentation was not really indicative of anything in reality. If that $100 million credit holding company were actually in the queue with $50 million in 16 credits and $50 million in 17 credits, how would they be paid off? The version of this page that your aide is now printing will indicate that. The version in front of the members is the alternative if the smaller appropriation were to pass, and I believe there'll be an amendment that's heard that would implement the version that's before you. So really, the second page is more our analysis of a proposed amendment.
Okay. Let's just take a brief at ease while we get that piece of paperwork. The first sheet has just been distributed, so Mr. Alper, if we could just ask you to briefly summarize these two documents now that folks have both of them in hand.
Sure thing, Madam Chair. Let's start with the one you just received. Again, we're imagining, and this form, and it says confidential, not that there's anything confidential here, obviously, but this form with the unique particulars of a given company was sent to the 37 impacted companies by Deputy Commissioner Barnhill twice, once when the bill was first introduced, and then again to internalize the changes from the spring forecast. And then again, this bill uses the spring forecast. Let's imagine a hypothetical company with $50 million in credits in the first pool of 2016 credits and another $50 million in the second pool. Under our estimation, if $184 million were appropriated for FY19, let's just say that represents about 45% of the $400 million in total 2016 credits out there. So everyone holding those credits would be paid roughly 45 cents on the dollar of their full amount. And you could see that that this company would be eligible to get $23 million in FY19. So that makes sense. Similarly, the $168 million, that's the statutory appropriation for FY20, would pay off about another 40% of all those 2016 credits, and thus this company would get $21 million. The FY21 appropriation, which is also, from memory, I think also $168 million, would be split. It would pay off the last remnant of those 2016 credits and then the first portion of the 2017 credits. Similarly, thank you. Looking at slide 9 from our previous presentation, that FY22 and 23 numbers would be proportionally paying down that company's share of the 2017 pool until finally the 2024 appropriation would actually be a fractional appropriation to pay off the last remnant of the 2017 credits. So based on that cash flow, which is in the column labeled face value, that's what the company would expect to get paid. If that cash flow were then given the two different discount rates contemplated by the bill, how much would they actually get for the credits they would be receiving in those future years? So the FY19 money is not discounted at all because that's what they would be getting anyway. The FY20 money gets the discount rate one time. The FY21 money gets discounted essentially twice because they would get 10% and then another 10%, and so on until the last year that they receive payments. So adding up those columns, you could see that this theoretical company, depending on whether they met the threshold of the lower discount rate, would be offered either $84.8 or $91.5 million from the state if they were willing to give up their $100 million in credits and participate in the program. So this is material to the bill before you and an analysis that we intended to provide based on our testimony on Saturday. If we could flip to the second page, anticipating the question, and I really didn't expect this to come up until an amendment was pendent, was the what would happen to this analysis if the lower appropriation schedule were used instead of the one written into the bill. And that lower appropriation schedule would be based on a percentage not of the raw tax calculation, but on a percentage of the tax calculation after subtracting credits, essentially a percentage of the actual taxes received rather than the raw tax calculation. And if that were to happen, the appropriations would be in the 40, 50, and getting up to $60 million range in some of the outer years. So that same credit holder would not get through all of their 2016 credits until 2025 or 26, I believe, and then the last half of the credits there, the last half of the years, would be paying off their 2017 credits. Because of that, even though it's the same $100 million in value, there's a lot more discounting that's happening because there's a lot more years of multiplying by that discount rate. So the effective change would be at the 10% rate, instead of getting roughly $85 million, that company would be offered $56 million, and instead of at the lower discount rate, instead of 91 and change, that company would be offered a bit less than $73 million. So from the perspective of the credit holder, the taxpayer, it would dramatically change the amount that they would receive. From the point of view of the state, it would reduce the amount we had to borrow and therefore pay down over the intervening years.
Representative Pierce, then Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And indeed, this does get to amendment number one, I think it is. But before we get there, which of these two scenarios would you say more accurately reflects or more closely reflects the net present value of these credit assets to the companies?
Through the Chair, Representative Parrish, I honestly don't know how to answer that question. The company's internal economics and valuing is not known to us, and they all differ. The companies, to the extent they're anticipating anything, I believe are anticipating at this point in time the statutory appropriation, such as it's been done for the last 2 years. So as far as what discount rate they would be willing to accept, what's their actual trigger point by which a company would say no thank you, which I think is really where your line of questioning is going, I don't know.
Follow-up?
But thus far, everyone with whom you've spoken about the the rate, which entails the state borrowing more money, has been amenable. And thus far, even someone who could hold $140 million of tax credits would be amenable to a 70% payout, when a 73% payout could be offered under the statutory formula based on actual taxes paid instead of hypothetical taxes. Is that all accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, it's important to kind of break down what the gentleman from ING said when he was before the committee, because he was describing a relationship. His company doesn't hold credits. His company has debt, which was guaranteed by tax credit. So essentially, once we pay the company who actually did the work, the money actually goes to ING. And what they told the committee was they're owed about $100 million. There happens to be $140 million worth of tax credits held by the company, of which 100 is pledged to the company, to the bank, and 40 is not pledged to the bank. So from the bank's point of view, they'll get their 100 if we paid 70 cents on the dollar roughly, but the company who did the $140 million worth of work would not. They would essentially get nothing. So I think you would get a different answer if you had a representative of the actual explorer up here rather than their banker.
Hello?
Sure.
Well, it's probably safe to say that they'd want 100 cents on the dollar?
Through the chair, I think they would like as much as they can get, but barring that, they would like an amount that would enable them to continue in business.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could also respond.
Sure. And if you just, the two male voices, identify yourself, please.
Mike Barnhill, Revenue. Going back to the spirit in which the administration proposed this bill and some of our early slides in our slide deck, we're trying to find a balance between the state's interests, the tax credit holders' interests, interest within the legislature, and we think that the bill as introduced struck a fair balance. Regretfully, I think if this amendment were to be adopted, that balance would no longer be fair. From the administration's perspective, we don't think it would be fair. It's not something that we would support. We're trying to find a way not only to clear the decks, but clear the decks in a way that accomplishes a variety of purposes. Paying off the tax credit holders is certainly one of those purposes. But just as important is attempting to reestablish the state's credibility with respect to the oil and gas industry and restore the state of Alaska in the perspective of the oil and gas industry as a place to come and invest money. And with respect to the amendment, which isn't quite yet before the committee, and respectfully, we think this amendment would not do quite the job that we would like to do in terms of restoring the state's credibility as a place to come, invest real money, and be compensated. So saying to the oil and gas industry, come, and we might give you 50 cents on the dollar down the line, that's not a message that we feel comfortable sending.
Okay. Representative Parrish, you're done?
I wonder if it wouldn't be appropriate to offer the amendment at this point.
Well, let's just see. There are two other questions, and then we need to get to amendments, and I'm determined to figure out if we don't get through this, we're looking at the schedule right now, figuring out, like, the next available time in this room, either later this evening or early in the morning. So I do want to try and keep moving things along, but Representative Birch and Representative Josephson both had a question.
Well, for what it's worth, Madam Chairman, I'm ready to move this out of committee right now, absent the amendment. So if that helps you in your deliberations on timing and schedule. I am intrigued through the chair that you mentioned, Mr. Alpers, you mentioned 37 contacts or beneficiaries were, did I hear that right? Regarding how many different businesses are impacted by the inability of the state to fulfill their obligation to pay the tax credits back?
Through the chair, to Representative Birch, the number is 37. Now, not a number of those were named and listed and published as the people who received cash from the state in the year 2017, the public report that I believe is part of this committee's record. There's others who might have had, those were all pro rata shares of the companies with 2016 credits. There are some additional, and all of them still have some credits. There are new companies that have 2017 credits that didn't appear on the 16 list that would get added to that list to make the sum total of 37. So 20-something of the 37 are publicly known. Of those 20-something, some of them are very small, and I'll put it on the record, small, like, and they received $10,000 or even less. There are some very small working interest partners within the Point Thompson unit that where there's an in-holding within that unit. Obviously, Exxon is the operator, and they have a number of working interest partners, but atypical for the North Slope of Alaska, relatively unique to Point Thompson, there are a dozen or more, hundredth of 1% or less shares of that field, all of whom were participating in the tax credit program and received a proportional payment last year.
Follow-up?
Sure.
So it's fair to say these are largely Alaska businesses with Alaska employees looking to go to work. And I guess I'm looking at the discount rate, and if I understand it, you got a kind of a two-tier discount in that one tier actually incentivizes investment in Alaska and maybe does steps in a small way towards restoring Alaska credibility in the oil and gas arena, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I'd like to hope that both discount rates will help restore the credibility. As Deputy Commissioner Barnhill said, the lower discount rate is a little bit of a – it doesn't so much encourage reinvestment as it rewards reinvestment, because one of the methods by which a company gets that better discount rate, and the one we frankly expect would be the most widely used, would be a commitment to take the entirety of the amount, the $92 million in the example here, and commit to spend it on and the term in the bill is qualified capital expenditures. That's a statutory term that's been around since we went to net profits, and it means upstream capital expenditures within the oil field, upstream of the point of production, of that amount or more within the next 24 months. So if we're going to give you $92 million, you have to commit to spend $92 million in your oil field in the next 2 years. And and it has to be a hard enough commitment that the Commissioner of Revenue will sign off on it.
Great. Paula? I would just say that we've come a long way since the 2011 Alaska Oil Production Enhancement Act kind of kicked all this off, and I certainly hope that you get the support you need to move this forward. I think it's a very innovative proposal, and it'd be nice to clear the deck and get this managed for a change. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. Representative Josephson.
Just a sort of a question, sort of a comment. But the if Amendment Number 1 were adopted, I mean, part of what you did with the 10% discount rate was, as you noted, to reflect a sort of mean in terms of the cost of capital to the independents, and this would sort of obliterate that and open up a possibility that they would sell assets under the current statute or be foreclosed upon in some way. It seems to me.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the word obliterate is the exact right word.
Okay. It doesn't seem like we have any other questions that are unrelated to amendments. And so without further ado.
I do have one question.
One more?
Related to the amendment, yeah. To follow up on something Mr. Elper said, I'm glad to hear that you would anticipate the reinvestment being the most common of the four available categories. If I had a small multi-million dollar company on the North Slope, or you know, worth some hundred millions perhaps, and I had a patch which I knew to be at least a little bit marginal, and I thought that I could get a better return on my investment elsewhere, is there anything to prevent me from agreeing to an overriding royalty interest and then pulling up stakes the next year?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, you would, if that was your intent, you would have to be lying to the Department of Natural Resources, because the overriding royalty interest is a negotiated agreement. It would have to be agreed to, negotiated, and with the expectation of a certain likelihood of success and a certain value to that royalty interest. If a company were to do that, I imagine they would lose their credibility with the state of Alaska for what that might be worth.
Thank you. Less, I think. I move amendment number one.
Sure.
Okay. There's objection. And just amendment number one is 30-GH2863/A.2. No A.1 in our stack. A.2. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. This changes the language of the bill by deleting the language before the application of any tax credits that parallels the language and statute, which doesn't make any reference to the application of tax credits, and it gives the department the option of following a repayment schedule based on the actual taxes received rather than the hypothetical taxes received, which are under the bill as it currently stands. It would serve to reduce the risk to the state, reduce the dubious debt that the state is considering incurring, and would bring us closer to the real market value of the asset in the appropriation. Furthermore, I think it's likely to reflect the real state of affairs in the state of Alaska, as people are increasingly less likely to see their money go to subsidize very often multinational interests.
Representative Birch.
I speak in objection to the amendment. I think the word we heard in testimony was obliterate the intent and objective of this proposal, so I think it's not a good idea, and urge a no vote.
Thank you, Representative Birch. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm just trying to clarify what I'm hearing, that we, at one time, they rolled the dice and they invested in Alaska. Now, if they want to see that money, we suggest they roll the dice again and invest in Alaska. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. I'm not going to answer that, but I may, perhaps the amendment sponsor would like to answer that. And we'll allow this bit of dialoguing. Representative Parrish, if you'd like to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, they decided to roll, they decided to invest in Alaska, sure. They presumably read their contracts. I certainly hope that they did. I have nothing but respect for people and their ability to serve their rational self-interest. Where it gets murky is when you start moving around other people's money. And there's no mistake that what we're contemplating is other people's money, not the oil interest, the oil industry's money, because it's not money, it's tax credits payable according to a certain formula set forth in statute or usable against liability. The money that we're contemplating spending for a decade to come and more is money that belongs to the people of Alaska in the very final sense of the word. And when it comes to balancing the interests of the industry and the interests of Alaska, as the deputy commissioner put it, I feel pretty firmly in the Alaska camp, and I feel that my constituents have sent me here to represent the interests of Alaska, and this seems to achieve that in an equitable way. And again, the language doesn't tie the hands of the department, although in retrospect I might have had it drafted a little bit differently. Does that answer your question, Rep. Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time.
Any other questions? Do you like to offer any additional comments, Deputy Commissioner Barnhill or Director Alper?
Madam Chair, just briefly, go back to the original intention of the tax credit program. It was for the state of Alaska to invest alongside the oil and gas industry in expanding the exploration and development of our oil and gas resources. Again, what we're trying to do is create this virtuous cycle where there's new investment, there's new production that results in new royalties and new taxes that comes into the state's general fund as well as into the state's permanent fund. It produces higher dividends, increased unrestricted general fund revenues that can enhance the ability of the state to meet the needs of its citizens. With respect, an amendment like this walks the state in the opposite direction. It sends a signal to the industry that Alaska, while it may with its words say we want to invest alongside the industry, is actually doing something quite the opposite. I think this would send a profound signal into the industry that Alaska is not competitive with respect to all of the other oil and gas basins around the world. And that's a signal I think the committee should be very cautious about sending, particularly when the state is in as profound a fiscal crisis as it is. So with respect, I understand wanting to be fair to Alaskans, but I think we have to think about the long-term ramifications to sending signals like this.
I guess I'll just offer my own comment on this. This bill has been a challenge for me in that I, you know, just sort of underscore sort of what a mess we've gotten ourselves into in terms of having to go out and borrow money to pay back these debts. We're several years behind in paying them. We're not following the statutory formula. So I guess in retrospect, perhaps this whole credit program was not the right way to go. And it's hard for me because we didn't have many strings attached to those credits, and so there are ways that we could have done it to be much more beneficial. But hindsight is 20/20, so that puts us where we are today. What is challenging is that if our financial circumstances do not improve, that if we go through forward with this proposal, because a non-payment of the debt would result in downgrades to our overall state's financial position, it prioritizes payments of these non-interest-bearing debts that are subject to appropriation right now over other things like health care or education, because funding of those or non-funding of those does not lead to a downgrade in the state's financial position. But once we go out to debt and offer, issue bonds for this and to pay this debt, then non-payment would result in a downgrade of our financial position. And so it sort of elevates and prioritizes them. So that's why this calculation becomes a lot more important to me, although I understand what the Deputy Commissioner is saying about the overall intent. And so it's just a challenge in the context of the challenging fiscal times that we have and the other competing priorities and sort of how do you rank them all. So that's part of my consideration. Any other comments? Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we had talked about amendments, and I had considered making an amendment. And as we move forward in the amendment process, one of the things I did, I went back and carefully listened to some of the testimony, and I know Co-Chair Josephson did as well, of both our Assistant Attorney General and our debt manager, Mr. Mitchell is here, Mr. Milks, and what Mr. Barnhill and Mr. Alper had to say previously. And I listened very carefully as and realized I went through kind of through Section 3 up to Section 11 in the bill, which describes a lot of the payment and the structure of it and everything. And going back and listening to the testimony of people that I consider to have the expertise that I certainly don't have, I'll just make the statement. I'm not comfortable with any amendment right now. I would certainly prefer that we move this. I think it's got another committee referral, which would be the Finance Committee. I know they will call on the expertise of these gentlemen as well. But, boy, when I re-listened to that testimony and really looked for a place to amend, I'm not very good with terminology. It got very squishy, in particular when the Assistant Attorney General and some of the things that he had to say and their evaluation of it. So I just wanted to make that statement, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Mm-hmm, of course. Any other comments or questions for the amendment sponsor? No? Okay. In wrap-up then, Representative Parrish.
Actually, Madam Chair, I fancy I can count. And if it's the will of the committee, I'm content to withdraw this amendment at this time so that we can end and hopefully move the bill out in a timely fashion.
Okay. So amendment number one is being withdrawn?
Yes, Madam Chair.
That brings us to amendment number two.
I move amendment number two.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you. Following our discussion last time, it emerged that the state, under this scenario, is still exposed to a good degree of risk. And furthermore, there is a risk if the state's true cost of interest substantially rises that will erode the incentive to participate in any of the qualify qualifying categories for the discounted rate. That is, again, having a seismic credit, agreeing to an overriding royalty interest, although I'm troubled to hear that it might be backed by little more than the good word of our investor companies, and reinvestment, and finally the special category for corporate income tax for refinery infrastructure credit. So that one doesn't apply as much. But if we allow the differential between the higher rate and the discount rate, if we allow that distance to be closed, we will be functionally disincentivizing reinvestment in Alaska. That's simply the nature of the beast. I also increased the differential that covers the state's risk in this. If we should have another precipitous drop in oil taxes, or in oil prices, by increasing the addition to the true cost of borrowing from 1.5 to 2%, which I consider a fairly modest change.
Thank you. I just want to let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Johnson at about 3:05, and Representative Drummond had joined us about 2:19. I see questions from Representative Birch and then Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be interested in some assessment of this amendment from folks here testifying today. Thank you.
Okay. Let me just go to Representative Rauscher, and then maybe it can be a two-for-one. He has questions.
I'll object for the sake of discussion. I also just want to know, are we going to argue this one out and then withdraw it later because it's after 3 already?
Appreciate that. Thank you. And we're just double-checking to see how long we can push our presence in this room. If you want to respond then, please.
Sure. Madam Chair, Mike Barnhill, Department of Revenue. So there's two changes in this amendment number 2. One is increasing the cushion that we've described from 1.5% to 2%, an increase in 50 basis points. The maker of the amendment suggests that somehow could be related to a drop in the price of oil, provide additional protection. It really is the impact of this amendment really has no relation or does not afford any additional protection if the price of oil drops. So the 1.5% plus the true interest cost is designed to replicate the state's opportunity cost of capital, which is roughly 5%, which more or less reflects the rate of earnings that we get on our earnings reserve account / general fund / CBR. So the question really is, do we need additional cushion in order to protect that opportunity, that estimate of opportunity cost of capital? It hasn't really nothing to do with the drop in the price of oil. We think 1.5% is a sufficient cushion for purposes of this bill. It's fine. There's some major impact to the investment markets, neither 1.5% or 2% is going to do anything to implicate that or mitigate that in the short term. We're looking at long term, 10 years. Are we going to get that opportunity cost of capital? We think yes. With respect to the other piece of it, that's increasing the default discount rate for the participants in this from 10% to probably something like 10.6%. So it's adding an additional 60 basis points. And there, the issue is not protecting the state. It's just sort of tipping that balance more in the state's favor. We picked 10% intentionally to kind of be a median point, if you will, between the state's cost of capital and what we think the tax credit holders' cost of capital is. 10.6 tips it, you know, more in the state's favor. That's a policy call. We'd prefer not to do that at this point in time. So that's our position.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes my questions on this. I appreciate that, and I will be a no vote on this amendment.
Okay.
May I clarify something?
And just one moment. We're getting into this precarious situation of needing to get kicked out of this room. This is a high-priority piece of legislation. So I want to try and complete our work before the next floor session, and that way if this bill passes out, it can be read across and it'll be ready to be heard in the next committee of referral.
Can we call a question?
We've got just a couple of minutes, so if we do not complete our work right now, we will recess till 8 a.m. tomorrow morning in this room, at which time we will finish the work on this bill. We will not consider any other item till we're completed with this work on this bill. But it is a big deal, and so I don't want people to feel like they're pressured or rushed, so we're just trying to sort of accommodate everyone. But I don't want to take any time that's not necessary. Representative Parrish, you asked for a point of clarification on your amendment.
Yes, thank you. It pertained to a remark made by the Deputy Commissioner. Actually, a price in oil would dramatically affect our opportunity cost by changing the schedule of repayment under existing statute. That's all I wanted to clarify.
Madam Chair, having just sort of nodded in agreement with the Deputy Commissioner, I think what Representative Parrish is referring to is we're sort of locking in the payment schedule at the bonding moment, that we are going to make them a one-time offer. We're going to give them a bunch of money based on what the schedule of payments would be if our spring 2018 forecast comes in true. If, in fact, the price of oil is lower, as the representative implied, that schedule would decline, and those companies would actually be getting less, so they'd be benefiting, so to speak, from the structure in the bill. Likewise, if the price of oil would be higher than forecasted in the spring, they would be losing out by taking the offer at this point, because it turned out the scheduled payments would have been higher than anticipated. So, yes, to the extent that is true, it's exaggerated a little bit by increasing the interest rate, the spread.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to recess this meeting until 8 a.m. tomorrow, when we'll plan to complete action on this bill.